Good evening, everybody. Welcome to our fourth class tonight of Mitzvah Universe. We started, just to give a quick synopsis, we talked about Chesed, we spoke about Torah and Chesed, and we spoke about breaking down levels of Chesed. Last week we spoke about our first mitzvah of Chesed, which is hospitality, Hachnasat Orchim, welcoming guests into our home. And these classes are available online. Thank you to Jacob Stalin, who's posting them. And there's a link on the Amichad bulletin. You can download, you can click, you can stream and download the classes now. So you can listen to them on the go. You're welcome to do that. If you've missed any of the classes and you want to catch up, no problem. It's on the Amichad bulletin. It's on last week's bulletin if you didn't delete your email. Okay, so this week's class is the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala. So I'm trying to be selective of the mitzvot that relate to Chesed, to loving kindness, that are pertinent and we practice and that we could improve on in all kinds of different ways, in the depth and in the, you know, in the practice that we engage in. So what is Hachnasat Kala? So we're going to learn about what Hachnasat Kala is. It's hard to define, but it means bringing in the bride. So it relates to, if you will, if you relate to marrying off a couple, being involved in the marriage of a couple. We're going to see different aspects of Hachnasat Kala. This term Hachnasat Kala appears in our Siddur. It's interesting because in the morning, when we say the morning blessings for the study of Torah, so then we say a few short paragraphs from different citations of the Talmud on different mitzvot. Like we say the blessings over Torah in the morning. It's in your art school Siddur, probably page 6 or something. And then immediately there we say, you know, Elu Devarim Shein Lahem Shiur. And we say this little paragraph about special mitzvot. We do a little study of Torah immediately when we make the blessing, so that the blessing is directly connected to the act of study of Torah. And that's what we do immediately in the morning. And we say this paragraph, and we say, Elu Devarim Shein Lahem Shiur. The following things have no limit. There's no limit to the extent that you can do them. Ha-peya, ve-ha-bikurim, ve-ha-reayon, u-gmilus chasadim, v-salmu Torah. So I'm not going to go into details. A whole number of mitzvos, but there's no limit to how far you could fulfill this mitzvah. For example, Torah study. Okay, that's an example. How much Torah do you have to study? What's the minimum amount? Saying the Shema in the morning and in the evening is a minimum requirement for a man. And a woman is obligated to study, in general, the mitzvot that she practices. Okay, but there's no, how much do you have to study? Is there like a maximum? There's no maximum. The more the better. Okay. Elu devarim, then the little section goes on. It says, Elu devarim sh'adam ochel proseim b'olam hazeh v'akeren kaimus l'olam haba. The following things a person will enjoy the principal benefit in the world to come, but will have some benefit of the mitzvah in this world. Ve'eluhe, these are the mitzvos. Kibud avaim, honoring your parents, and so on and so forth. Ve'achnasat kala. So the term appears in the Siddur, that bringing the bride into or under the wedding canopy, the chuppah, is the mitzvah of hachnasat kala. And that mitzvah is a mitzvah which is so unique that it is a mitzvah that you'll benefit from in this world partially, but the principal reward for this mitzvah is in the world to come. Okay? So it appears in our Siddur, this term, Hachnasat Kala. What is Hachnasat Kala? How do we fulfill the mitzvah? What are the sources? And so on. So we already mentioned that all the mitzvot of Chesed are rooted in the general principle of loving a fellow Jew as you love yourself. V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. All the mitzvot are rooted in that. When I say all, I mean the mitzvot of, let's say, burial, the mitzvah of a burial of a fellow Jew, the mitzvah of comforting a mourner, the mitzvah of hachlasat kalah, the mitzvah of hospitality, of welcoming guests into our home. All these mitzvot are included in loving your fellow Jew as you love yourself. So that's the original source, if you will, in the Torah. But the rabbis, as we've mentioned last class, the rabbis articulate for us the particular ways of fulfilling the mitzvah. That means the Torah gives an umbrella definition. Love your fellow Jew as you love yourself. That's very broad. How can I fulfill that? The rabbis come, and the rabbis dictate the details of how to do that. One of those details is our mitzvah, hachnasat kalah. So here I have several different sources, and we're going to see that hachnasat kalah could be fulfilled in various different ways. Number one, this is a midrash, beautiful midrash. If you ever speak at a Sheva Brachos, nice thing to say. Okay? So the midrash says the following. Then Hashem Elohim fashioned the side that he took from Adam, that he had taken from the man, into a woman, and he had brought her to man. So that's the pasuk in the Torah where it discusses the creation of Chava. So the midrash says as follows. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai stated, he adorned her like a bride and then brought her to him. From this verse we learn that the very first act of chesed in the entire Torah, other than creating the world and humanity, of course, is the chesed that God did for Adam. God acted as a matchmaker, if you want to call it, as a intermediary of introducing, not only creating Chava and just having a woman in the Garden of Eden for Adam to explore and say, oh, look at that, a woman. You know, not something like that, but Hashem actually intervened and acted as the conduit to introduce Chava to Adam. Rabbi Chama ben Chanina added, do you think that he brought her to Adam from under the carob or sycamore tree? You know, there was a nice big tree and he just left her, created her, put her under a tree, so to say. Left her under the tree and then brought her to Adam just from under that tree, you know, under one of his creations? No. Rather, Hashem certainly decorated her with 24 elements of jewelry and then brought her to him.
Good evening.
Good evening. Welcome. Okay, so he adorned her with 24 elements of jewelry and brought her to him. What's this 24 elements of jewelry? What does that have to do with anything? So the principle generally is that Hashem, like we say in Yiddish, bedecked, Hashem adorned, Hashem edified, Chava adorned her with jewelry and, if you will, makeup, and beautiful clothing, and all sorts of trimmings to bring her like that, so nicely beautified as a bride would be to Adam. Hashem didn't just plop her in Gan Eden and fend for yourselves. You know, Hashem actually introduced Chava to Adam. The significance of 24 pieces of jewelry is that there are 24 books in the Tanakh. Each one of them, and this is a theme that's throughout the writings, the Ketuvim, our third section of the Tanakh, that in Mishle and so on, that the books of... Oops, what's the door coming? Is the door locked? The door is locked? Hello. There's a seat right here. Okay, now I'm out of handouts, so... So the message is that just like there's 24 books of the Tanakh, they are like, if you will, like jewelry for a Torah scholar and for those who study Torah. The 24 books of Tanakh, each one of them is another gem that you can adorn, just like you go and you buy a beautiful necklace and, you know, a locket, and you have a bracelet. Each one of the books of Tanakh metaphysically adorns a Torah scholar. Every time that one who studies Torah completes and internalizes the studies of a book of the Tanakh, so it's like jewelry. That's a theme that's in the Ketuvim. So from there, they make a parallel that Hashem adorns Chava with 24 pieces of jewelry. That's antithetical. That's a side point. That's not the main point. The main point here is that Hashem brought Chava to Adam in a beautiful way. And that's the first place in the Torah that we can see the concept of Hachnasat Kala. So what does that tell us about the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala? What's one element of the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala? How can we be involved in the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala?
When a bride is getting married, to be involved in helping with how the end product, you know, from top to bottom, you know, the makeup, the clothing, the needs.
Right.
I guess the material needs.
Yeah. Maybe? All the material needs.
Or maybe the spiritual. Maybe it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's
right, by extension, I guess, the spiritual. Particularly here, we're talking about the physical needs. Making sure she has a beautiful dress. You know, she has all the makeup and jewelry that she needs. She's all set up, outfitted appropriately for the event. And obviously, by extension, not only the event, but for her life. You know, she's gonna get married. And she's going to be, you know, the day after the wedding, she's going to need to live in a home. She's gonna, you know, hopefully that's going to come together as the couple meets and plans their life, their future life ahead. But one aspect of being involved in Hachnasat Kala is setting up the young woman or the woman, whoever she is, at whatever stage she is in life, when she's getting married, to set her up and to make sure that she has what she needs. And any edification that we can be involved in her needs is the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala. Okay, any questions or comments about that? No? Should we move on? Okay, let's move on. Yeah? Let's move on. Did anyone want to say something?
I was just wondering about the 24 again.
Yeah.
Because this was really the first Kala.
Right.
And if it was 24 adornments, why isn't that part of the learning of the Kala?
What do you mean by the learning of the Kala?
I mean, shouldn't the Kala learn just this to bring it to her that how serious this is, how important this is, how not stung. You know, I mean, not that it's just mm-hmm. you know, what are you doing mm-hmm. today? I don't know. I think it's so beautiful mm-hmm. that it just kind of surprises me. This is the first I've ever heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
24. And because it's 24, or it should be 26, but it's 24 because of the Tanakh.
Yeah, everything that takes place at the Jewish wedding is symbolic of so many different other aspects of the union of the Jewish people with Hashem. So the jewelry and the adornments, you know, it goes into also, you know, all the houseware gifts, you know, the bedding and the kitchen stuff and all the towels and all the stuff that you think about to, you know, to get it, the shower and everything. That is all part of the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala. When you go to a bridal shower, you're not only going to a bridal shower, you're contributing to the mitzvah of Hachnasat Kala. It is a mitzvah to participate in providing for the new couple, particularly for the woman's needs in this particular point. That's what we're focusing on here. But yeah, and that, you know, there's so many parallels. You know, that the bride is likened to the Jewish people. Just like a bride is all prepared when she comes to the chuppah. She's all prepared, and she's prepared for this day, and, you know, so much preparation that's gone into getting ready for the event. And now they're coming together, and they finally can be united. So too, the Jewish people are at that state of always ready to be united with Hashem. That's why we're like Hashem's bride. That's the explanation of the Maharal. The Maharal explains the reason we're likened to a bride, the Jewish people are likened to a bride, is because we're always prepared to connect to Hashem. Just like the bride who does so much preparation to come to the point of marriage, to unite with her groom, so too the Jewish people are prepared. And there's so many parallels, and that would be a parallel. We are prepared. One of the things that edifies us as the Jewish people is that we have the 24 books of the Tanakh. That's like the bride wearing all the magnificent jewelry and beautiful clothing and so on, all the physical preparations. Yeah, absolutely. So that's a beautiful thing to, bring home, But there's a lot more to bring home to the Kaalah, so sometimes things are lost in the shuffle, but that's also one of the beautiful points. Okay, let's move to the next Gemara. So now maybe this Gemara will also provide us other insight about other aspects of Hachnasat Kaalah. This is a famous piece of Gemara, this piece right here. The rabbis taught in a Braita. A Braita is a text, an original text, very similar to what is known as Mishnah. So it's older than 2,000 years old. It's one of our primary texts. And the rabbis taught in the style of a Braita. They said the following. Acts of kindness are greater than charity in three ways. So they're trying to promote people to be involved in acts of kindness, in chesed. Apparently, when the Braita is written, or the authors of the Braita are confronted with a social dynamic that people are involved in charity, but not necessarily in proper social behavior. If we take the context of the Braita, we remember that the Second Temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred, sinat chinam, between people. So to give charity, no problem. As long as I don't need to see your face, I can give you charity. Just put the check in the mail. I don't want to interact with you. But if I need to welcome you into my home, and I need to actually care for your needs and investigate your needs and so on and so forth, then that's a lot more difficult. So the rabbis are, in the Braita historical context, the rabbis are trying to promote, during the Second Temple period, they're trying to promote the acts of kindness amongst people. So this is one of the sources that's doing that. That's why it's an important source for us. We could actually see, not in our community, but we can see that sometimes in the larger context, Jewish context, that people don't get intimately involved in the needs of others. Fortunately, our community is very blessed with that, I believe. But, it's something that we always need to work on and strengthen. So, what are the differences between charity and acts of kindness? Charity is performed with one's possessions. You give money, you donate your car, right? Car's for kids, you call up, you give your car, you're done, right? For the cake, right? While kindness is with one's possessions and with one's person. That only works if you're invested with the person. So even when you do chesed with your car, let's say someone says, you know there's someone in need, let's say of a vehicle in the community, just give me an example, and you have an extra car. So you loan your car to that person. So even when you do chesed with your possessions, that's greater than doing tzedakah with your possessions. Because doing tzedakah with your possessions, you make the donation, you're done. As long as they take care of the paperwork, you're okay. Right? You don't want to hear from it, you'll just make the donation. That's how tzedakah is. Right? You write the check, and you're done. It's a one-time event. Whereas, the person's going to come and pick up the car. They said they'd be here at 3, but they're not here yet. It's 3:15. They're running late. Oh, this guy, I never should have loaned him my car. Forget it. He's not going to fill it up. He's not going to bring it back with the tank full. And, there's going to be a lot of wear and tear. And he's going to bring his dog into the car. All the problems that we come into in chesed. So even when we're not actually doing chesed with our person, we're not ourselves serving the person a cup of tea or whatever it might be, or helping out Hachnasat Kaalah, but even when we use our possessions to do chesed, it's much greater than doing charity with our possessions. Very interesting. Very interesting, because it requires, it's a greater strain on our lifestyle, on who we are, on our privacy, on our person. So even when you're doing chesed with your possessions, you're really doing chesed with your person. You're giving him your car, but you have to wait around until he comes and picks it up, and you know, and all the problems that you're going to go through with the whole gamut of chesed. You're like, this is chesed, I'd rather just give him, for all this, I just give him my car, forget about it, I don't need him to bring it back, for, you know.
So if you complain about doing a good chesed and complain that he's late and he's going to do it, that's not a mitzvah at all.
Well, you're still doing a mitzvah, but you're doing the mitzvah begrudgingly. So you wouldn't get as the reward of getting a, doing a mitzvah begrudgingly versus the reward of doing a mitzvah with joy cannot be compared one to the other. The service of Hashem with joy is the service of Hashem, whereas when you do it begrudgingly, you're doing it, but because you're doing it reluctantly, you know, it doesn't demonstrate that you're doing the service of a great king of Hashem.
Right.
So you're doing it. You know, it's you're doing it. Yeah, it's getting done. You know, you're being functional, but you're not being, you know, involved and engaged and enthusiastic. So you don't get that excitement, that level of metaphysical and spiritual engagement. You don't have that, and you'll lose out. You don't have that reward, right? Okay, number two. Charity is performed, excuse me for the spelling errors, I typed this. Charity is performed with the poor, while acts of kindness with both poor and rich. Right? Even someone who's wealthy might need your assistance sometimes, right? Charity is performed with the living, while acts of kindness, as we well know, are performed with the living and the deceased. So even when you do chesed with the living, and even when you do chesed with the rich, and even when you do chesed with your possessions, it's a much greater act than doing charity with the poor, with your possessions, who are living. It's much greater because you're tapping into a different system. It's a wider system. It's not just the same act, instead of giving him the car, I'm loaning him the car. No, I'm tapping into chesed, not tzedakah. It's a different criteria. So how is this relevant to what we're talking about? Rashi, who's the foremost commentary to the Talmud, on this piece, Rashi says that hachnasat kala, and I'm just going to use those words generically, hachnasat kala, welcoming in the bride into her wedding canopy, preparing her for marriage, is a form of chesed. So therefore, giving her our possessions, and you're doing it even with the rich, and obviously with the living and the deceased, in this case obviously it doesn't apply to the deceased, but it applies to even the rich, and even loaning your possessions. So sort of like what we know, for example, in many cities, for example, there is a gemach, there is a gmilut chasadim fund, there is a kind of like a loaning department where people hold it in their homes or whatever. Let's say they have gowns for brides. Not every bride is going to buy her gown because ultimately she's just going to buy it one time. You know, not everyone's going to buy a dress and then send it to the dry cleaners and box it up for the next 8 years. You know, not everyone's going to do that. You know, some people, they'd rather spend the money on other things, even if they're wealthy. You know, they'll buy the gown for themselves, and then immediately they'll donate it. You know, so there's so many different systems, right? So you can do gemilut chasadim with the rich, and by loaning your possessions. So another way is by funding the wedding. If you fund the wedding, let's say you bring all the, you know, you have a loaning gemach, you loan the candlestick holders and the canopy and the I don't know, the tablecloths and, you know, all the different needs for kala. That is the mitzvah of achnasat kala, and that's what we learn from this piece of Talmud as well. So not only her physical needs, her own personal needs, if you will, but also the needs for her wedding. And that's what we learn from this piece of Talmud. Yes, Tani.
So if chesed is more important than charity, why is charity mentioned on like Yom Kippur? Like Marvin, you know, to get rid of the evil decree, why wouldn't you say chesed?
That's it. Okay. You catch me by surprise with that question, but I think I could answer it. different. So I wasn't expecting that question, but I think I could answer that question.
Okay.
The answer is basically that in the same piece of Talmud, which I didn't cite on this page at all, even though I'm going to cite this Talmud on the other side, another piece of the same page, but there's another piece on the same page that says that not everyone who wants to do chesed can just jump at the opportunity and do chesed. You need to have the opportunity. Let's say you want to give the chatan and kala, you want to give them something for their wedding that they could use at their wedding. They say, no thanks, we already have it. We don't need it. Or we're not using that at our wedding. We're not doing that ceremony. Or we're not, whatever it is, you know. So chesed is dependent on others. That's one of the reasons actually we don't make a blessing over chesed, or any act of chesed. We don't make a blessing even though it's a mitzvah. Right, when we light the Hanukkah candles in a few weeks, we will make a blessing. When you do an act of kindness for someone else, you don't make a blessing, even though it's a mitzvah. Why don't you make a blessing? Because since it's susceptible to rejection, a person might say, you know, that's enough. Or, I don't really need it right now, thank you very much. Or something like that. And they might turn you down, so you're dependent on their acceptance, and therefore you don't make the blessing. So to answer your question, on Yom Kippur, when people are trying to act in the present, and trying to save themselves, you know, with that sense of urgency. So what will speak out is teshuva, tefila, utzadaka. So those are the things that they can do now, regardless of, you know, if someone's around or not. You know, they could do tzedaka, right? But tzedaka, there are needs for tzedaka. And chesed, you person might say no, but tzedaka, you can always give tzedaka. Even if there's a well-to-do synagogue or yeshiva or day school or kollel or whatever, you can always give them more and they can always put it to use. Whereas chesed might be rejected. You know, you never, I don't think in the history of the day schools, you've never had a day school call up and say, thanks very much for the donation, but this year we're doing fine. You know, no. So that's just to answer your question. Does it, here it's like immediate, you can address it. Okay, so that's another way to be involved in Achnasat Kala, and now I bring you a third way of being involved. The rabbis taught in a Braita, again a Braita. Torah study, should be interrupted for carrying the dead out to burial, right? In those days, not as so much today, but in those days, because of the way they would bury their dead, the burial plots were always out of town because of, unfortunately, the smell that would come from the graveyards, and therefore they were always out of town. And therefore it's always called Hotza'at Hamet, taking out the deceased. They would carry them out of town. They would have a procession to honor the deceased after they would do the eulogy, and they would literally walk with the deceased out of town, and they would go to the graveyard. Okay, and on a happier note, and to accompany the bride to her wedding. So we interrupt Torah study. This is a big topic. When should you interrupt? If there's other people involved, who should interrupt, and so on. The general consensus is that even if there's 400 people at the wedding, and you were also invited to the wedding, nevertheless, you should consider attending for this mitzvah. Even if you have Torah study, you should try to work things out so that you can attend and be involved in the mitzvah. Because there's no maximum for Hachnasat Kala. Right? We know the minimums, you know, you want to have the basic needs. But even there's 400 people making the Chatan and Kala happy, nevertheless, you want more people to make even more, to make even happier. So therefore, one should be involved. So what does it mean, accompanying the bride to her wedding? So accompanying the bride to the wedding means, to says Rashi, again the foremost commentary to the Talmud, Rashi says, to accompany her from her father's home to the wedding canopy. So that was how it was traditionally. Traditionally, they would, you know, in the morning, the groom would come to the bride's home. They would veil the bride. That's where he would perform the ceremony. And then in the afternoon, everyone would gather where they would have a feast, and then the Chatan and Kala would be alone in the Yichud, in the seclusion, in the afternoon. It would be like a whole day, you know, event, you know. That would be very exciting for, I think, in our community. It would be like a whole day wedding. That would be a lot of fun. Go from one place to the other, and then, you know, it costs a lot more money, obviously. So that would be, you know, that's what accompanying means. Accompanying means accompanying her from one location to the other, and we don't have that anymore. So what's our accompanying of the bride? So the Drisha, one of the halachic decisors, he writes, it defines that hachnasa to the chuppah as the bedekin. So today, when the groom walks to veil the bride at the bedekin ceremony, and you accompany the groom to the bedekin, that is, she's now going to veil the bride and prepare her for her coming to the chuppah. So when the men would accompany the groom, and then the women accompany the bride after that ceremony, they go and they accompany her to prepare for her chuppah. That is the mitzvah of hachnasat kala. That is the core of the definition of bringing in the bride to the chuppah. When she's veiled, she's all ready to go. Moments before the chuppah, you're gonna prepare her to bring her to the chuppah. That is hachnasat kala. And the people that are most intimately involved in that are generally the parents that walk the kala to the chuppah. And the groom who greets the kala and brings her into the chuppah. And that anyone who's involved in the procession, in the preparation for the procession, and the procession to the chuppah, that is literally the mitzvah of hachnasat kala in its strictest form. So everything else is a wider definition. Okay. No rebuttals? No? Okay. Okay. Okay, let's get a little bit interesting over here. So the question is, we all know a beautiful song, Ketzad Meraktim Lifnei HaKala, how do you dance before the bride? Right? So there's a big debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, yeah, about how to compliment the kala. There's a mitzvah to dance before the kala. That's part of this is a separate piece. This is not the core of hachnasat kala, but once they're at the wedding, it's great getting them to the chuppah, but then they're just going to sit there and eat a meal and that's it. That's not a Jewish wedding, we know. Right? So you're going to get there and you're going to dance and you're going to get excited and you're going to say things to the chatan and you're going to say things to the kala to make them just elated. They're going to be so enthusiastic and happy and you want to increase their joy. Well, what are you going to say to the kala? Right? Or what are you going to say to the chatan about the kala? Let's say the bride's not so pretty. So what are you going to say? You know, nice, what are you going to say? You know, machloket Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. Are you going to say, you know, are you going to compliment her and say, she's a beautiful bride, you know, such a wonderful girl, look how pretty she is, and so on. That's what you're going to tell the groom, you know, to show the groom that, you know, you're going to compliment her and he's going to feel so happy that he has such a wonderful bride. Is that what you're going to tell the groom? But maybe it's not true in this case. I mean, you're embellishing the truth.
It is. Well, the big bride that night has a glow. Has
okay. Okay. That
even
is.
Even an ugly
so
one.
That is, okay. So that is. So there's a certain glow. Let's not talk about what kind of thing she's glowing. Okay. But what are you going to tell the groom? Are you going to compliment? Are you going to compliment her? Or are you going to say?
Exactly.
The way she is, she's prepared so, she's beautiful the way she is. The way she is beautiful. Right? Kala na'ak moshehi. The way she is beautiful. What do you say? Do you tell the truth or do you bend the truth because of circumstances? So the halacha is, that's a song at the wedding, at every Jewish wedding, they always sing, Ketzad Meraktim Lifnei HaKala. How do we dance in front of the bride? Kala na'ava chasuda. She's a beautiful and charming bride. So that's a song. It's a Jewish song at a Jewish wedding, and it's a very exciting song, and we sing this at almost every wedding that I've ever been to, and it's there to speak about the beauty of the kala, and to make the groom feel, you know, enthusiastic and so excited about that he had such a great pick. You know, he's such a wonderful wife that he's marrying. such a wonderful girl. She's also gorgeous. Wow, beautiful. So excited about it. Okay. So that is the halacha. That's what we do. The question is, who should be doing this? Who should be doing this? Can a Torah scholar who's, you know, not a young guy, you know, someone who's a very accomplished Torah scholar, you know, is he going to get up there and dance in front of the Kala? Is he going to dance and sing in front of the Kala? The Kala is going to sit there, this, you know, in some cases, a young girl, maybe she's, I mean, in the times of the Talmud, she's definitely young, okay? What is she's maybe what? She's 13, she's 14, maybe in earlier times she was 18, maybe even today in some circles she's 20, and very young. And you have this older gentleman who's a Torah scholar, who's dancing and humbling himself in front of this young woman in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Simchat Chatan Mekala. Is there an imbalance there? Should he do it or not? So there's an interesting question about this. There's a question that was written to one of the foremost halachic decisors about 150 years ago, that this Torah scholar knows how to play the violin really well, the fiddle. You know, he's a fiddler. You know, so he wants to get into the circle, and he wants to, you know, play the fiddle to entertain the kala. And he asked the question, can I do this? Can I do this at the wedding? That was his question. So the answer first was, there's nothing wrong with this. This is not humiliating. You're not humiliating yourself. That's a nice thing, you know. It's a dignified thing. You know, people are professional musicians. They're going to play in front of the chasen and kala, you know. And you're just taking the violin, the fiddle, and you're going into the circle and you're playing it. That's very dignified. But even if we were to assume that it's undignified, let's say, for this person, it wouldn't be as dignified. You wouldn't expect to see, you know, a prominent, let's say, rabbi, you know, who's the leader of a community and so on, picking up the violin and in front of, you know, 500 people playing a little tune for the cow. Possibly, let's say that's overdoing it. Let's say. It really depends. It depends on a big discussion, and I'm going to get a little detailed over here. Depends on a discussion about if there's an opportunity for a mitzvah. Let's say there's a lost item in the street. So every one of us is obligated in the mitzvah of returning a lost object, Hashavas Aveda. But let's say it is something that it's not so respectable for the average person for someone who's very honored to pick up. Let's say it's a kid's knapsack, you know. You know, I work at a school, there's backpacks all over the place, lunch boxes, things full of dust and dirt, the kids throw it against the wall, it gets smashed, it gets ripped. You know, it's lying in the street, it's a Jewish community, you know it belongs to a Jewish kid, walks along a rabbi on the street, he sees the backpack is lost, should the rabbi bend over and fulfill the mitzvah of returning the lost item? He has an opportunity for a mitzvah.
Yes. Why not?
Why not? Well, it's not respectable for this very honored person in the community for his Torah scholarship to be, even though it's a mitzvah, he's involved in the mitzvah, but to be involved in picking up the little kid's backpack and calling the parents and saying, you know, the backpack was lost. It's a great thing for him to do, but should he do it? So the answer is, he doesn't have the obligation to do it. Whether or not he can do it is a disagreement in the major authorities. If he has the right to override his Torah honor to participate in a mitzvah which will humble him.
I have a question.
Yes.
About, are there mitigating circumstances to that? Let's say a woman's purse, which he certainly wouldn't want to pick up and walk down the street with.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if a woman loses her purse, she loses a lot of very important things.
Right.
So, is that... Would he consider that, you know, the consequences of leaving the item where it is? Or?
Right. So, you know, if it would... It sounds like that would not necessarily be an exception because of the... You know, if... if that's to be considered as humbling, not that the person should be arrogant. That's not what we mean over here at all. We don't mean arrogance, personal arrogance, and that's a flaw in character. That's not what we're talking about over here. The person says, "Well, no, I don't get involved in that." Walks by. Not that. But the person has to realize their position. If this person is a distinguished, accomplished Torah scholar and is well respected and held up in great esteem in the community, such a person needs to realize their place and how vis-a-vis the mitzvah that he needs to fulfill, that might create a social imbalance in the way he is to be viewed by the community. So it's not such a personal thing. So even in that case, that will probably qualify for something that's not appropriate for him to be involved in. The question is, this rabbi, hopefully, is a very humble person anyways. Hopefully. Huh? And he says, you know, I don't mind. You know, someone like you said, you know, this woman lost her purse. You know, the kid's lunch, okay. But, you know, this woman lost her purse. You know, she has her driver's license in there. There's probably money in her wallet, her car keys. You know, she has personal items in there. You know, she's probably missing it. This is really something I want to be involved in. Does the rabbi, or I'm just using rabbi as a generic term, but does this accomplished person in Torah study, who's well respected by the community, code word rabbi, does this rabbi have the right to override his status and be involved in the mitzvah?
But isn't it said about people knowing that he's a great Torah scholar, and therefore if you see them doing something like a mitzvah like that, then there's no humbling there. You know that they've got that horrible backpack or that lady's purse for a good reason.
Right.
So there's an obligation on the community to understand what a Torah scholar is doing.
That's true. So if they see him perhaps picking it up or something like that, that might be true. But let's say in Malka's scenario, where the rabbi is walking down the street with the purse hanging over his shoulder, or, you know, holding this little, you know, diamond purse, whatever it is, you know, this evening, walking the poodle, whatever it is, you know, that, you're right. It's upon the community to say, wow, he must be doing that for a good reason. I didn't know the rabbi just bought a poodle. You know, I didn't know he was into purses like that. You know? Wow, he really must be from, you know.
I was thinking about the Mickey Mouse lunchbox.
Oh. You know, it is upon the community to judge the situation accordingly, but it's also upon him to maintain a certain appearance, not for the honor of Torah, So there's a responsibility upon him as well. Their responsibility doesn't relieve him of his responsibility. Mm-hmm. They both need to act, and in this case, their responsibility would not relieve him of his responsibility. Therefore, he has to keep that. Sometimes, someone else having the benefit of the doubt for you would sometimes alleviate you of you having to go the extra mile to, but not in this case. So that's really the discussion, actually. So some say yes, and some say no. Could he bypass it or not? So they want to apply the same language to here. And that, you know, so the point is not so much, obviously, none of us are very distinguished rabbis in the community that are so super accomplished, that are held on such a pedestal that shouldn't even pick up a lady's purse that's on the street, whatever. It doesn't apply to any of us, so why are we talking about it? Well, the reason we're talking about it is to demonstrate the extent to which is upon every single individual to participate in the dancing for Chasan and Kala. That's what I'm trying to bring up. That there's a discussion, even if this great rabbi should dance in front, sometimes, in front of the young woman who's, you know, 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, 14, 13, who's getting married, this little girl, you know, could be his great-granddaughter, and here he is, this elderly rabbi, trying to do all these little moves in front of her. You know, it's not dignified. What's he doing?
I think it's cute.
It's cute.
What's the problem?
Well, that's exactly the problem.
It's cute, isn't it? Rabbi Levi, I was about to pick up the garbage, and he went ahead in front of me. I said, Rabbi Levi, said, it's all your garbage. And I thought that was great.
Beautiful.
I mean, that was really beautiful.
Beautiful.
If this rabbi is so high up there and he's not allowed to pick up something, then what does it make him?
Right. Well,
you know, he knows his way.
Well, no.
So he goes down a little bit.
I agree with you 100%.
It's okay.
All our leaders should be humble.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And someone who's not humble has a great character flaw. And many of the people in the Tanakh who were great, you know, accomplished people were not humble. And that was their downfall. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Over here we're not talking about his personal character that he might, you know, harbor this character flaw. Let's say he doesn't. Let's say he is humble. But he has a responsibility to carry himself with that dignity. You know, that's one of his responsibilities. When he rises to such a level, he needs to rise to that occasion, even if he doesn't like it. He might be very uncomfortable with that level of status, but he has no choice. He carries the crown of Torah. He has to represent it.
On the other hand, if he is that type of a rabbi, a lot of people around him would not allow him to go down and pick it up.
Okay.
They'll do it for him.
Right. So in this case, when he has the opportunity to dance in front of the Kala, should he do it?
Okay.
So what's relevant to you and I, what are simple people, is that even in front of that, how far it goes, how far reaching it is, that this is a mitzvah that's binding on everyone. And even the, you know, the well, you know, regarded scholar, you know, exquisite scholar, he too is most probably included and should humble himself in front of a kala in order to gladden the kala. And quite in fact, that his just being there would gladden the kala. You know, a well-known rabbi who lived in Bnei Brak. His name was Rabbi Kanievsky, known as the Stipler. The Stipler never went to a wedding when he was younger. He was so immersed in study, he decided that it's his place to stay and not to go out to the wedding, but to stay in the yeshiva. And he said, and now, my mere attendance, when he got older, he said, my mere attendance at the wedding, that itself, I go in for a few minutes, that itself is an honor. The fact that the Stipler came to the wedding, you know, that itself like blew people's minds and made the kala so happy. He didn't even have to dance for the kala. He didn't have to do anything. The fact that he walked into the hall, everyone stood up, he said mazel tov, and he walked out. That itself was, you know, like a tremendous honor. So the very fact of that people are present, people of great stature, that itself gladdens the kala. I'm short on time. What I want to do, some of these, all these are translated in English, and I want to be respectful of the time. I'm going to be selective. I want to talk about three more things. If you bear with me, I'm going to try to squeeze them in, because I think they're important. One is, if you turn to the second side of the page, so item number two, listen to this one. Talk about dancing in front of the kala. Rav Acha put the bride on his shoulder and danced. The rabbi said to him, so the surrounding students, they said to him, are we too allowed to do so? Yeah, every time I go to the wedding, no problem. Hop on my shoulders. You know, we'll dance around we'll dance around. No machitza, nothing. You know, just hop on my shoulders. We'll dance around in the wedding hall. He replied to them, if carrying the bride is likened to you like carrying a beam, which means that you are not thinking about her, that you're not, there's no attraction, that you can say for yourself, I am confident that I'm involved purely in the mitzvah, for the mitzvah's sake. Yeah? So in that case, then you could do it. It's fine. But otherwise, you may not. So nowadays, the Toras Chaim cited over here, he says that no one's of that stature. No one can say that when they pick up the young bride, who's all, you know, jeweled and beautiful and everything, on their shoulders, dancing around, they're obviously not going to be able to make this statement, so therefore we cannot do this, obviously, anymore. But the question is, what about dancing with the bride? Meaning not the father of the bride, and not the groom. We're talking about guests at the wedding dancing with the bride. And in the Hasidic circles, this is very prevalent. It's called a mitzvah tanz. Mm-hmm. A mitzvah tanz is the mitzvah dance. Right? So how do you dance? They take a long... obviously, they're not holding the hands of the kala, because, as the Gemara states, they're not going to be able to engage physically with the kala and be able to hold themselves back from thinking about her, and therefore it's not going to be modest. But they have this in the Hasidic circles. We don't have this in our community. It's very, very few communities, like very Hasidic places. They dance with the kala, very great rabbis and guests and so on. They have the mitzvah tanz. It's an honor to be called to be danced with the kala, and they use a long, whatever, napkin,
scarf,
you know, belt, whatever they're using to dance with the kala, this really special dance, the mitzvah tanz. Mm-hmm. So, unless the halacha is that unless you have a specific custom to do this at the wedding, you're not allowed to do this. We don't do this. But in the Hasidic circles, this is really considered a very lofty part of the wedding. Bringing up what you said, that there's so many mm-hmm. parallels to the Jewish people and Hashem and so on. Dancing with the kala, when the kala is at her wedding, that is the most demonstrating of the state of the Jewish people. And having the honor of dancing with a kala at her wedding is a very great honor. In a sense, you're engaging with that representation, if you will, the individual personal representation of the high level that the Jewish people have with Hashem. So that's why it's held in such high regard. But it's only in the Hasidic circles, because they have that sensitivity or that tradition which is, you know, mystical. So unless you carry that mystical edge, you're not going to have that in a regular community.
What about, I mean, the men lift the chair? I wondered about that as well.
Right.
Because she's sitting on a chair.
Right.
Holding on for life.
Right.
But
it's all
right. Yeah, you're sorry. But I mean, there are men. The men are doing that.
Okay. So that's, you know, that's something that every person decides for themselves that they want to be involved in. You know, it's fine. It's not you know, if a person, you know, they're not making direct physical contact, it would be like the mitzvah tanz, you know. And it's something that, you know, it depends on the individual people. You know, depends on the individual person. I wouldn't necessarily condemn anyone. I wouldn't necessarily condemn anyone who did it or compliment anyone. You know, it's up to the person. If they want to be involved, that's fine. No problem. Mitzvah of making the So that's another interesting point about being mesameach chasan v'kala, making the chasan and kala happy at the wedding. I want to touch on two more points. Donnie, is that okay? Two more points? How am I doing? Is it 9 o'clock?
9 o'clock.
Okay, so give me 5 minutes. Okay? Okay, thank you. Thank you. I'm not going to read through this last piece of Talmud at the bottom, but you can read it for yourselves. But essentially what the Talmud says, an amazing statement, the Talmud says that you're required to display, to act at a wedding with modesty, with walking with Hashem. You can take a look at the piece of the Talmud yourself. But the Talmud teaches that even in matters when you're involved in a mitzvah, there should be, even when you're outwardly involved in a mitzvah, certainly when you're inwardly involved in a mitzvah, for example, giving charity in private, so you should do so modestly. What does it mean modestly? No one knows that I just sent a check from my banking account, you know, from my checking account to a charity. So obviously I did it modestly. No one's ever going to know. No one's looking at my finances, right? No, well, but how do I feel about it? What are my inner thoughts? Do I feel like, I just gave charity? You know, you feel all proud and so on. Or is it a moment where one's thoughts are modest thoughts? Thoughts of, I'm doing this mitzvah in a modest way. I'm connecting with Hashem. I'm feeling the humility in the presence of Hashem while I perform this mitzvah that Hashem commanded me to do. So the Talmud teaches, and you'll look at the piece, you can take over the piece and look at it. The Talmud teaches not only in public affairs, such as being involved in a funeral procession or eulogy, or happier events, gladdening a chassan and kala and dancing in front of them. Not only in those events should a person act with modesty in their heart, but certainly then in things you need to do with modesty, like giving charity, certainly you should be modest in your heart. But the point that I want to take from this piece of Gemara, which is really, really important, and perhaps the most important thing that I have to share with you tonight, is that when we celebrate a chassan and kala, there has to be, in order for it to be a meaningful mitzvah, there must be an inner thought process, something that's going on inside, that I'm happy within in a modest way that no one can discover about the joy that I have for doing this mitzvah. It's especially important at a wedding where everything is so public. All the dancing is public, all the ceremonies are public, the mitzvah is almost entirely public. So how important it is for us not to just ride the public wave, things that are happening publicly, and have a superficial experience of the wedding. The wedding must be, in order for it to be a mitzvah before Hashem, each one of us would need to incorporate within ourselves a humility, that we feel the humility before Hashem. When we're dancing in front of the chassan or the kala, then we are not only dancing in front of this person, we're dancing in front of the kala that represents the kala, which represents the higher level thinking of the Jewish people, and she's adorned with the 24, pieces of jewelry, if you will, and she represents something higher. I'm dancing before Hashem and the representation of what the kala is. And when I'm dancing before the chassan, I'm dancing like in front of Hashem, and so on. There are deeper levels that we should be experiencing, and that comprises the modesty that we feel at the wedding, for example. Those are my thoughts for right now, and out of time. But that's what I want to share with you, and I'm going to throw in one more thought, Donnie. I'm sorry I'm stealing your time, but one more thought I have to throw in. And that is that the Talmud says, the last piece, the Maharal explaining the Talmud and Brachos, says that the main reward for celebrating with chassan and kala is the words that you say to the groom and the bride at the wedding. The words that you say. If you say to them, look at this wonderful, partner that you now have, this groom, this bride, they're so amazing, they have such talents, they're so beautiful, and so on. You compliment the chassan and kala, you really make them truly happy. And the Maharal adds, this is the last point, the Maharal adds that it's especially important to reach that point at a wedding. The point of full expression. When you reach the point of full expression, then you're at maximum simcha, maximum joy. You're at a point where you're, so to say, bursting forward with joy to the point that you're expressing the joy to the chassan and the kala. That is when you're really rewarded for your joining in the joy of a chassan and a kala. If you're just enjoying at the wedding, you're having a nice time, but you haven't reached that outburst point, that point where you can come to the chassan and the kala and say, you're so lucky, you got such a great birth, this is so wonderful, I'm so excited. If you're bursting forward, that's when you get the true reward for being Mesameach chassan and kala. Until that point, you haven't reached the point of full expression. So that's an insight from the Maharal. Hopefully this will enhance all of our celebrations in the future. Okay.